funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WVUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. The heat is on for seven Democrats in bone-cold New Hampshire today, amid possibly record turnout. Here and Now host Robin Young will join us live from the Granite State to discuss, among other things, the election's wild cards. Voters still making up their minds.
Well, I'm still undecided, which is shocking because it's so close to the race, but I'm a nurse and I'm interested in healthcare, and I want the right person in office because healthcare is a mess.
Also, Colin Powell's harsh words on Russian democracy, and Tony Blair could lose his job over university fees.
There is a sizable number of Blair's own Labor Party in Parliament who simply haven't forgiven him for taking the country to war in Iraq.
These stories and more coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Democratic presidential candidates are stumping in the snow of New Hampshire today. Voters are choosing candidates in the state's primary election. General Wesley Clark stopped to greet voters.
Thanks a lot for being out here. Hey. How y'all doing?
Congratulations.
Great to see you all. Thanks so much for being out here.
While Senator John Kerry expressed some optimism about the voters' decision.
We're just working all day, working for every vote.
And
I feel great personally, but, you know, you got to work for every vote, so I'm hopeful.
Senators John Edwards and Joe Lieberman, former Governor Howard Dean, Congressman Dennis Kucinich, and Reverend Al Sharpton are also stumping for votes. The polls close in New Hampshire in 8 hours. The wintry weather isn't just affecting New Hampshire. Parts of the South are suffering through sub-freezing temperatures and ice. Scott Jagow of member station WFAE reports.
Throughout the Carolinas, nearly 3 days of sleet, snow, and freezing rain have turned roads into skating rinks and tree limbs and power lines into icicles. At least a dozen people have died in weather-related car accidents. Schools and many businesses have yet to open for the week. Tens of thousands are without power, many of them in the Midlands of South Carolina, where a half an inch of ice knocked out electricity to more than 200,000 customers. Today, a freezing drizzle compounded the problems of restoring power, but Carolinians know things could have been much worse. An ice storm last winter cut off power to nearly 2 million people. This storm will soon be a memory. Sunny skies and highs in the 40s tomorrow should help life return to normal. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte.
The Oscar nominations are out. The third installment of the Lord of the Rings films leads with nominations in 11 categories. It's followed by the Russell Crowe film Master and Commander with 10 nominations. Best Actress nominations were bestowed today on Diane Keaton for Something's Gotta Give, Samantha Morton for In America, Charlize Theron for Monster, Naomi Watts for 21 Grams, and on 13-year-old New Zealander Keisha Castle-Hughes for Whale Rider. Actress Sigourney Weaver had more nominations to announce.
The nominees for Best Performance by an Actor in a Leading Role are Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean, The Curse of the Black Pearl, Ben Kingsley in House of Sand and Fog, Jude Law in Cold Mountain, Bill Murray in Lost in Translation, and Sean Penn in Mystic River.
The awards will be announced and given out on February 29th. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 55 points at 10,647. The NASDAQ is down 26 at 2127. The S&P is down 6. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Federal Reserve is holding its first meeting of the year today. Members of the Fed's Open Market Committee, including Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan, are gathering behind closed doors in Washington. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Though virtually no one expects the Fed to take any action on interest rates, observers will nonetheless be closely watching this Fed meeting. Stuart Hoffman is chief economist with PNC Financial Services Group in Pittsburgh. He says a particular interest will be the statement issued at the conclusion of the two-day session.
People want to see what they say about the economy and say about inflation. That'll be the more interesting outcome is their statement and their feelings rather than any action that nobody expects them to take.
That includes whether, as in past statements, the Fed will say it's prepared to keep interest rates low for a considerable period. Analysts say with little inflation and a jobs picture that remains relatively weak, the Fed can probably afford to keep interest rates at their present 45-year lows for some time. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
Opening statements began today in the Manhattan fraud trial of entrepreneur Martha Stewart. 8 women and 4 men were seated yesterday for the jury. It also has 6 alternate members. Judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum has instructed jurors to stay away from news reports, even though several jurors admit they've seen a great deal of publicity about the case. A private business research group reports consumers were increasingly confident in January. The conference board says its index of consumer confidence soared 5 points this month to 96.8. The last time it was this high was July 2002. Still, the jump was short of what economists were predicting. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
The NPR Shop features The Geographic Century, a CD from NPR's radio expeditions on great moments of exploration in the 20th century, at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
It's Here and Now.
Democratic candidates for president are making their final appeals to New Hampshire voters, who are expected to turn out in record numbers today. The traditional very first results are in from the tiny northern towns of Dixville Notch and Hart's Landing. Ballots cast there right after midnight. Here's how it went in Dixville Notch.
Picking one vote each was Howard Dean and Joe Lieberman. With 2 votes, John Edwards. And the runner-up is John Kerry with 3 votes. And Wesley Clark received 8 votes.
We take it pretty seriously, and it's a great tradition, I think, that they started here.
But elsewhere, results await the 8 in the evening closing time for the polls in what's been for many in New Hampshire a very compelling primary. Here's a voter from Webster, New Hampshire.
It's been very interesting. I heard it, and I'm mimicking what a lot of people have said, that there's a tremendous amount of talent in this group of Democrats, and I'm still undecided.
And these thoughts from another voter in New Hampshire's capital, Concord.
It's very exciting. I think it's going to be close. New Hampshire always dismisses what happens in Iowa. So just because Kerry's ahead in the polls doesn't mean he's going to win. So it's really kind of interesting, but still very much undecided.
Well, my co-host Robin Young is in New Hampshire's largest city, Manchester. And Robin, undecided still seem to be the huge factor in this race.
Hi, Bill. Yeah, as we're going to hear over the course of the program today, we met several undecideds still at a factory in Manchester. And then just this morning, April Peavy, our producer, and I went down to the Blessed Sacrament Church. It's right down the street on Elm Street here in Manchester, where Ward 9 votes. And we saw a lot of undecideds coming in to register. Now the New Hampshire is a very open primary. So what they can do is they can come in, they can register, vote, and then unregister on their way out so that they can maintain their fierce independence up till the general election in November. That ward has, by the way, about 4,000 people registered, and they expect a huge percentage, maybe 89% of Democrats. I have a sample ballot here, Bill, and it's funny. There's actually 23 candidates running for president in the primary here in New Hampshire, many people you've never heard of. And there's also 14 candidates running for the Republican primary, but of course they only expect a small turnout there because George W. Bush is the only candidate many people expect to get many votes on that ballot as well. But interestingly enough, there's also a place to write in your choice for candidate for vice president on the ballot, so we'll be hearing about that as well as the results come in. But it is just the excitement. Excitement is in the air. You know, people might poo-poo this primary, but not if you live here in New Hampshire.
Well, we turn now to WBUR's Bob Oakes, who's at a polling place in the state capital of Concord, New Hampshire. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Trish Anderton, who's in the northern town of Berlin. Welcome, Trish.
Nice to be here.
Bob, you've covered a few primary days in New Hampshire. How's turnout look where you are compared to other election days?
Well, I have to say, and this was my own impression was that there weren't a lot of people going to this particular polling place I was at in Concord, Ward 7, nice historic building, one of the only built in New Hampshire specifically for voting. My suspicions were confirmed by the moderator when I went inside, and he told me that as of midday, only 400 of the 2,500 people who are registered to vote in the ward had actually gone to the polls, and he said he felt it was very average instead of hot.
Bob, what are voters telling you about what's driving their decision in the polling booth this day?
They're all over the map on that, Bill. The first couple of people we talked to happened to be wearing Sierra Club stickers, and their choice for a candidate was based solely on the environment. But we talked to other people who, for whom the abortion issue, the right to choose, was the issue. Leadership was also an issue. And then, of course, electability. A couple of people talked about that, and there was this cute moment when one lady who didn't want to be interviewed sort of scurried away from us, but turned and smiled and shouted over her shoulder, or anyone but Bush.
Trish, you are up in Dixville Notch, a town of only 10 Republicans and 16 independents.
Right.
Are there two New Hampshires, a very rural, even isolated New Hampshire, and that southern tier that's so close to Boston, just an hour's drive away or so?
I think to some extent, yes, that's true. I think there's a patchwork of New Hampshires. And certainly when you look at the northern half of the state, there are things you can say about the electorate. There are more veterans up here. People are a little bit older on average, a little lower income, and not as highly educated. So definitely sort of your average voter up here is more blue-collar than your folks down in the southern tier of the state. But when you look a little closer at individual towns, you really have more of a patchwork where you've got mill cities like the one that I'm in, and you've also got vacation towns, resort towns, where people are moving in and retiring and moving up for the mountain lifestyle, where people are perhaps a little bit more like those southern New Hampshire voters.
Bob, have you seen the candidates out in the South where you are?
No, I haven't seen any of the candidates working where we are in the middle part of the state today. However, the candidate supporters are all over the place, holding signs, holding placards outside polling places, on street corners, and it seems the number of people out seem fairly equally divided for all the candidates, and in a way that seems to be setting up what we're hearing from voters, that it was very tough to make a decision. Uniformly, people we talked to today struggled to make up their minds, some leaning toward candidates for a long time, but all of them only making up their minds within only the last day or two. This was a group that was very divided between the Democrats.
That's why I'm interested, Bob, to find that turnout has been kind of on the slow side so far, because there has been so much interest, and everybody I'm talking to is also struggling. And what I'm wondering is whether, A, they just gave up and decided they couldn't choose, or B, everybody's waiting till the end of the day hoping to get struck by lightning.
Trish and Bob, just to finish up, the latest sense of what matters to New Hampshire voters is that health care is the number one concern, not the Iraq War. Yet the town of Berlin is learning today that a young soldier from there was killed in Iraq over the weekend. Just very briefly from both of you, Bob first, how did the war play today?
I only had one person tell me that he voted based on the person he felt was best able to get the nation out of Iraq. However, interestingly enough, there were several Republican voters that we talked to today who said that they were voting, coming to the polls today to show the flag for President Bush, strongly committed, thinks all of them said they think he has handled the war well, but all of them worried that this fall's election is going to be very close with whomever the Democrats choose, all of them thinking it's going to be very tough into November.
And Trish, very briefly, you're in Berlin, where that young soldier was from who died in Iraq. Reaction up there?
I have not had a chance to talk to people about it, unfortunately, because I was up in Dixville Notch. When I have talked to voters about issues up here, I do hear about health care, but I hear a lot about jobs in Iraq.
WBUR's Bob Oakes is in Concord, New Hampshire. New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Trish Anderton joined us from Berlin, New Hampshire. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. So just how important are these primaries? Well, Robin Young is in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Well, Bill, just ask Eugene McCarthy, George McGovern, John McCain, Estes Kefauver. We're joined now by Dante Scala. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Anselm's College here in Manchester, the place where all politicians meet at one point or another. Welcome, Dante, first of all.
Good afternoon.
And let's just get right to Estes Kefauver. He's the fellow who started it all in the early 50s.
Yeah, certainly. 1952 was a watershed primary because it was the first time that the names of candidates actually appeared on the ballot, so voters could vote directly for them. Kefauver was a freshman senator from Tennessee, the John McCain of his day, Democratic senator, freshman senator, ran hearings, televised hearings, on organized crime, which was really something of a novelty back then. He decided to challenge the sitting president, Harry Truman, who described the primaries as a lot of eyewash. Now, at that time, primaries weren't decisive the way they are today in choosing a nominee. But Kefauver came up here to New Hampshire and began grassroots politicking. He'd go around to towns and cities around the state and meet people, shake hands, and get his name out there. Meanwhile, the party establishment was behind Truman but didn't do much for him, and Kefauver won the primary in an upset over Truman that year.
You help us with history, but also help me really understand for the first time how to pronounce his name, which I stumble over. But tell us about some of these other names, and as you said, how they play out in what you call the insurgents versus the moderates, which is a real theme here in New Hampshire in the primaries. George McGovern, Eugene McCarthy, of course, John McCain.
Yeah, certainly, New Hampshire exemplifies the split in the Democratic Party between elite insurgents who like reform candidates, who talk about changing the party, versus more traditional, moderate, traditional Democrats. And McCarthy and McGovern were two excellent examples where New Hampshire's liberal Democrats rose up against the party establishment and spurned the establishment candidates, Johnson in 68, Muskie in 72, and raised one of their own who promised reform.
In fact, how many times did something that happened here in the primary, an insurgent, as you said, stepping to the bat, force a sitting president to decide not to run?
Well, certainly we look at back to Truman, although it may not have been decisive, certainly didn't help when Kefauver beat him. In 68, Johnson saw the handwriting on the wall in New Hampshire, the sense that his presence in the party was too divisive.
And we've been scoffing, or many have been scoffing, at polling in the last couple months during the campaign. But you have a story from the 2000 primary here in New Hampshire that shows the polling can be very telling.
Yeah, my guess is by now, as in 2000, campaigns are looking at internal exit polls of who's coming out of these polling booths. Back in 2000, Al Gore found out that he was losing in all the exit polls in the morning to Bill Bradley. And that was the catalyst for a get-out-the-vote movement in the afternoon and evening where the campaign pulled a knock-and-pull, which is literally knocking on doors and pulling out voters. They went to working-class areas all around the state to get out that vote, and that, according to both camps, was what made the difference that day.
Well, in fact, when I was down at Blessed Sacrament Church, a polling place just this morning in Manchester, it's a church, so they have all the church. One wall has a big handwritten sign, "Our God is an awesome God," and people are pulling the levers under that. But there's an observation area, and there was one person in there with a clipboard. He was from the Dean campaign, and he was clipping off how many people picked up Democratic ballots to see, I presume, if they had to get out the vote.
Yeah, my guess is that the Dean campaign has already a list of names in Ward 9 that they know are for them, and they're going to want to make sure that each and every one of them comes out to vote today. Yep. So he or she will send notice back to the headquarters. Headquarters will phone people who haven't shown up yet to make sure they get out to vote.
You know, with just the minute we have left, for listeners in other parts of the country, we've been talking about this Democratic primary for weeks now, but oddly, this is not a Democratic state.
No, it's not. I mean, it's a Republican-leaning state. Republicans outnumber Democrats here by about 11%. And actually, Democrats make up just about one out of every four voters up here.
And so what is the controversy, briefly again, about New Hampshire continuing as first in the nation? Will it hold on to that as the state changes demographics?
Well, I think it's a conflict that comes up every 4 years when other states try to muscle in on New Hampshire. But still, I think New Hampshire has the support of, one, the national media, who like to see the candidates perform, and two, presidential candidates who like a level playing field.
Mm. Well, Dante, thank you so much. We should mention your new book is called Stormy Weather, The New Hampshire Primary and Presidential Politics, and it's a political storm, as well as the literal storm that we're expecting here in New Hampshire. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Dante Scala, Associate Professor of Political Science at St. Anselm's College here in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's Here and Now.
Well, turning now from U.S. politics to geopolitics, in strikingly blunt language, Secretary of State Colin Powell has criticized the government of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Writing in a Russian newspaper, Powell said that political power in Russia is not yet fully tethered to law. He also expressed concern over a lack of media freedom in Russia and Russian tactics in Chechnya. Yesterday, Powell made his concerns known in face-to-face meetings with the Russian president, though both sides glossed over their differences in later public comments. So is there a new chill between the two Cold War enemies now turned warm allies? We're joined by Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent in Moscow. Welcome, Fred.
Hi.
Fred, how surprising this public criticism from Colin Powell?
I don't think it's too surprising because Russia is changing. It is drifting toward a much more authoritarian form of government. It is becoming more assertive in the former Soviet states like Georgia and so on. And this has got to have some kind of repercussions in Washington.
Now, is this going to rattle Vladimir Putin at all? In polls, he's winning 80% popular support. How much does this matter to him domestically?
Oh, I don't think it matters at all. In fact, I think it's good for him to be seen taking a bit of criticism from the Americans. I wouldn't overstate this because I don't think anything is fundamentally changing. But there is a tougher mood in Russia, maybe a swing toward a more nationalist, perhaps a little bit more anti-Western point of view in the country. So all of this is grist for Putin's mill.
Fred, in your latest piece, you quote a director of an institute in Moscow saying the Americans have become increasingly messianic and want to impose their views of democracy and strategic necessity in every situation. This goes along with an American military presence in a number of former Soviet republics. How does all that play? Is that a reflection of a widespread attitude in Russia?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think there's a broad perception here that the alliance with the United States entailed mainly concessions on the part of Russia, letting the Americans move into bases in Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan and Georgia, helping them out in the war on terror and so on, with very, very little to show for it from the point of view of American concessions toward Russia.
So, Fred, you seem to be advising us not to make too much of this. Colin Powell said what he said. The Russian president doesn't much care, and neither do the Russian people.
It is important. There clearly is a change of tone. Wouldn't overstate it, but if it continues, we could indeed see that chill.
Finally, Fred, why do you think Colin Powell did this now?
Well, I think that the changes in Russia in the last few months, the parliamentary elections in December, for instance, just can't be overlooked. I think there are a lot of organizations, human rights groups and so on, pressuring, and quite rightly pressuring, the United States government to take a position on the ongoing war in Chechnya, on the narrowing of the democratic window in Russia. I think he's answering to a constituency in the United States.
Fred Weir, Christian Science Monitor correspondent in Moscow. Thanks a lot, Fred.
My pleasure.
Imagine sending a child to even the most elite university in the United States from day one to diploma for less than $20,000. Well, Prime Minister Tony Blair of Great Britain wants to raise university fees that high in Britain, and it may wind up costing him his job. This, along with the release tomorrow of a report on the suicide of a Blair advisor, are making for a perilous 48 hours for the Prime Minister in the British Parliament. WBUR's Michael Goldfarb joins us from London. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, Bill.
Michael, let's focus today on the question of this increase in education fees. Well, what's the Prime Minister's education bill all about?
Well, the higher education bill basically is trying to get more revenue going into Britain's universities. The universities suffer from lack of funding, and the idea is that they want to charge students up to £3,000 a year, which is about $5,500 at the current rate of exchange, in a top-up fee. In other words, you wouldn't pay while you're at university, but when you're finished, you would owe the government, you know, £9,000. But it's the principle that has Tony Blair's Labour Party backbenchers exercise. They think the state should make higher education free at the point of use. And a hardcore group is determined not to pass this bill. The problem is that this being politics, tonight's vote on higher education bill is not exactly entirely about funding higher education.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like an almost laughably good deal to anyone in this country who's trying to put a couple of kids through college. Got to be politics, I guess, right?
There is a sizable number of Blair's own Labour Party in Parliament who simply haven't forgiven him for taking the country to war in Iraq. And what they're trying to do is challenge his authority and precipitate possibly a leadership crisis that might lead to Blair having to resign. He's already said he would regard losing tonight's vote as a serious challenge to his authority, and there are, as we speak, enough people to challenge his authority and possibly not pass the bill.
Well, we'll get into detail tomorrow about Lord Hutton's report, but how dangerous is that for Tony Blair?
Well, Bill, it is potentially very dangerous. If you paid attention to the inquiry when it was happening during the summer and early autumn, the facts are already known to everyone. The idea is, what will Lord Hutton say about the government and particularly Tony Blair's role in preparing the notorious now dossier on weapons of mass destruction, which ultimately formed the main reason that Blair was able to convince Parliament to endorse his decision to take the country to war in Iraq? If Lord Hutton should really aggressively censure Tony Blair tomorrow for his role in creating the dossier and also in exposing the name of David Kelly, who is a civil servant and was speaking to the BBC on background, then Blair, if you combine that with a loss tonight, will be in very, very, very deep political difficulties. What you're faced with is the possibility that the marker will have been placed that marks the point where Blair's authority over Parliament and over the country was sent into terminal decline.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb from London. We'll talk to Michael tomorrow about the release of Lord Hutton's report on the suicide of David Kelly. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New Hampshire.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, we'll hear from voters in the First in the Nation primary here in the Granite State, and we'll also hear from foreign reporters about American democracy at work.
The young people who are standing up all night with the signs and the whole process going on peacefully without any kind of problems between different candidates, that's very impressive, especially for us as outsiders, people from the Middle East. What's going on affects us very much.
And we take another look at Capturing the Freedmans, the Oscar-nominated documentary of a family torn apart by accusations of child sexual abuse.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. More violence in Iraq today. A driver and a translator producer working for CNN were shot and killed by unidentified assailants outside of Baghdad. CNN says the two were returning from an assignment in southern Iraq in a two-car convoy that came under attack in the outskirts of the capital. CNN identifies the two men as translator-producer Dareed Issa Mohammed and driver Yasser Khatib. Also, three U.S. soldiers were killed and one wounded in a bombing incident in central Iraq today. Hospital officials say two Iraqis were also killed. Witnesses say two roadside bombs went off in a town about 50 miles west of Baghdad. The area is a hot spot of guerrilla activity where several attacks have taken place against U.S.-led coalition forces. Witnesses say the first bomb exploded next to a passing U.S. military convoy, followed by a second blast when reinforcements arrived. President Bush says today that he has, quote, great confidence in the intelligence community. His remarks come in the wake of a conclusion by retiring top U.S. weapons inspector David Kaye, who says he believes Iraq did not have the weapons that the Bush administration cited as a main reason for going to war. The president tells reporters at the White House today that he has no regrets about the U.S.-led invasion. United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan says the UN will send a team to Iraq to assess prospects for early elections if the U.S.-led coalition can guarantee security. Annan was asked by the U.S.-led coalition and the Iraqi Governing Council to consider sending a team to examine the possibility of holding elections before the return of Iraqi sovereignty on June 30th.
I have decided to send in a mission that will undertake this task. I hope they would also have the chance to talk to a large number of Iraqis, and I really hope that their presence and their efforts will help the Iraqis to come to a consensus on how to take the transitional process forward.
And the UN chief said the world body will send in a team as soon as security arrangements can be made. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 48 points at 10,655, the NASDAQ behind 27, and the S&P behind 7 points. You are listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire.
It's Here and Now.
Well, today's primary here in New Hampshire is, of course, focused on the Democratic presidential candidates. But last October, President Bush visited the Granite State to talk economy. And at that time, we asked employees of ElectroPack, a computer board factory in Manchester, New Hampshire, what they wanted to hear from President Bush. Their concerns then ranged from outsourcing, 1 in 10 manufacturing jobs has moved out of New Hampshire, to the cost of the war in Iraq. Well, late yesterday, we went back to the folks at ElectroPack, where sales manager Paul Vart agreed that the war in Iraq seems to be less on the minds of his employees than it was in October.
I think you're right. I think a lot of the war has kind of gone on, and it's more, again, toward jobs and health care, with health care being more than jobs.
Even though you work for a company, presumably you have health care through your company.
Yes, but our health care costs are still going up. We pay a portion of it, and it still goes up every year.
Kim Sanders, we take you away from your work. Circuit boards, you were sort of putting them on a conveyor belt of some sort.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you tell me, did you hear what you wanted to hear from President Bush last October?
No, I haven't. I'm not happy with the way that the war has progressed. It's not progressing enough to bring our boys home. I haven't really decided a definite who's going to be my choice.
Here you are. You're at the 11th hour. What is it going to take?
I like John Edwards. I'm still on the fence, though.
That must be very painful for many, all the New Hampshireites that we're meeting who are sitting on that picket fence.
Definitely.
And what have you heard from the Democratic candidates? Just take off the issues that you did like to hear about.
Taking care of our elderly and the Medicaid, Social Security. We have earned it since me, 14 years old, I've been working. And I would like to know it's going to be there when I'm ready to retire, to know that I haven't worked all of these years. And they're going to send it overseas to pay for somebody's rebuilding or, you know, something like that. That really bothers me. I don't mind helping other countries, but I think that we need to focus at home first.
Bob Wally, what do you do here?
Production manager.
What were your thoughts coming into this huge campaign season? Were you aligned with a party?
No, I was just looking to see who the best man was.
Just, you're one of those independent?
Pretty much, yeah.
Did somebody inspire you?
I'm a show-up kind of guy, so if you show up and talk to me, I'll listen and...
Did you like what you heard?
Yes, I did.
So do you know who you're going to vote for?
Not at this moment, no.
No, how is that possible? I mean, it's the 11th...
I won. Yeah. The only one has come through here, so... Joe Lieberman.
Well, so what's it going to take? What do you have to hear from a candidate? Because you are going to vote.
Yes, absolutely.
So what's it going to take?
It's difficult because you want to vote who you want to vote for. But if they have no chance, does that vote really count? Or does it really, you know what I mean? It's difficult.
You know, a lot of pundits have been critical of that, in voters in general. If you really like someone, then just vote for them.
I probably will. I mean, in this primary and all that, I will vote for Lieberman. And then you have round two. This is just round one. If nobody else comes up and kicks me in the head or wakes me up or shows me anything good, I'll vote for Bush.
What are the issues that the Democratic candidates mentioned that you liked, and what did they talk about that you didn't like?
Likes were finding out how to get some of the work back to the U.S. that went overseas. I like the tax cuts, but I don't want to. Tax cuts are tricky because you don't know who they're hurting when they do tax cuts. And $300 extra in my pocket to hurt somebody who's less fortunate than me doesn't make me feel any better.
What's the best part of having primary day almost over?
Commercials will be over. You know, 7 out of 8 guys telling you the same thing.
And we leave.
Well, that's okay. I don't mind. This is fun.
Bob Wally, production manager of ElectroPack in Manchester, New Hampshire. Well, New Hampshire is crawling with journalists today, some of whom are foreigners reporting for overseas news organizations. On Sunday, producer April Beavy and I got on a bus carrying some of these reporters. They took them to various campaign events, and I asked them for their impressions of the process they're witnessing.
I am from Spain.
And what are you doing here?
Well, we are covering this magnificent exercise of democracy.
Now I hear some laughter. Do you really see it that way?
Yes, I think it's amazing. We don't have open primaries in Spain. I think it's fascinating, without question.
Well, let this gentleman come through. Come on through. We got on your bus for a minute. Where are you from?
I'm from South Africa.
And your thoughts on the New Hampshire primary?
It's fantastic. It's just nice to see people exercise democracy so freely. It's not something we used to back home. Just a great spirit and a great sort of pride of people to participate.
Sir, where are you from?
I'm from Egypt. I think it's great. The young people who are standing up all night with the signs and the whole process going on peacefully without any kind of problems between the different candidates, that's very impressive, especially for us as outsiders, people from the Middle East. What's going on affects us very much, and that's why we're following it very closely.
Where are you from?
From Germany.
Tell us of some of the things you've observed here in New Hampshire.
It's a good chance to see all the candidates in person. I was struck by the concentration on domestic issues because I thought after the war in Iraq, the international relations would be more of a topic.
Thank you. I don't want to hold you up, but sir, where are you from?
I'm from Spain. I find more interesting in comparison to the system in Europe. Here in this country, the person is important, the candidate. In Europe, the party is more important. You tend to vote for a party, for a list of people. So here, all the candidates have to take a risk, have to present themselves for the acceptance of the people. So it's more direct democracy, and candidates have to be accountable. And that this fact I find very positive.
Well, thank you all so much. And take care.
It's very cold here.
Yes, it is very cold here.
Hang on, let me call you back in a minute, okay?
Thoughts from foreign journalists covering the New Hampshire primary.
And this note, a driver and translator working for CNN were shot and killed today by assailants outside Baghdad. The translator was identified as Duraid Issa Mohammed, who appeared on Here and Now several times in the past few months. The pair was returning from an assignment in southern Iraq in a two-car convoy that came under attack. Still to come, Capturing the Freedmen's captures an Oscar nomination. You're listening to Here and Now.
Last March, columnist Mary McGrory wrote about the contrast of the budding spring flowers and the budding war in Iraq. It would be her last column. Mary suffered a stroke soon after. She won a Pulitzer for her coverage of the Watergate hearings, but also wrote about Jane Austen. Columnist David Broder recently wrote that he dreaded hitting the campaign trail without Mary. We visited him here in New Hampshire and asked what he missed about her the most.
Well, I miss the laughs with her, of course, but what I really miss is her eye for the significant detail. And also, she had an absolute genius for finding the people in the audience who have the most interesting and unexpected reactions.
I actually was following her once here in New Hampshire. The pack of journalists would go in one direction, and she would seem to go in the other direction, including at one point down a manhole. She actually...
That's a wonderful story. I've never seen her go down a manhole. I've seen damn near everything else, but never that.
I have to say, very gingerly, helped by someone with a hard hat, but she leaned over the manhole and she said, "Excuse me, can I speak to you?" And they said, "You'll have to come down here." And she said, "Okay."
Well, she never let anything get in her way.
Was she objective?
No. Made no pretense of being objective.
Can you think of specific examples of how she might have treated an issue that struck you?
Well, The one that comes immediately to mind was up here 4 years ago, the Bush-McCain campaign. I mean, I remember going with her to a Bush event where she said, "That man is so ill at ease. I wonder whether he really wants to be president." A thought that never would have crossed my mind.
What was it about her use of language, which many, Tom Winship of the Globe, the editor, said was the best use of the English language?
Well, Mary read and loved poetry. She had an appreciation for the English language, which most of us never attain. And the passages of the 4 days from Kennedy's assassination through the burial were so beautifully written that the Star published them as a little booklet. I still get goosebumps when I read them.
We are here in Manchester. By the way, have your colleagues commented on the fact that she's not here? Is it that marked an absence?
Yes, it is a very marked absence, and many of us, in fact, over at NBC this morning, I was talking with Tom Brokaw, and he had his own stories about McGrory on the trail. She was unique, and I don't know what they teach in journalism schools, but if they are looking for a model of how you bring the reader absolutely right into the event and the scene that you're writing about, McGrory is the model that they ought to use.
Here's what she wrote 4 years ago. "New Hampshire's dilemma was poignantly expressed in a voter's question. Should we vote for the very best man or the one we think can win?" I think that resonates today, too, doesn't it, that same question?
It sure does.
David Broder, talking about his ailing friend and colleague, Mary McGrory.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young in New Hampshire.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
It's Here and Now.
The Academy Award nominations are out, announced this morning. And among the contenders for Best Documentary Film is Capturing the Freedmans, Andrew Jarecki's portrait of a seemingly ordinary upper-middle-class Jewish family whose world falls apart after the father and son are charged with child molestation. Much of the emotional hurricane that results is shown in the film, captured on home video, shot by the family itself. Capturing the Freedmans is released on DVD today. We spoke to director Andrew Jarecki back in June when the film was in theaters. I began by asking how he first learned about the Freedmans.
Well, I started out making a totally different film.
Ah. You know,
I started out making a film about professional children's birthday party clowns in New York City.
And that must have been how you met David Friedman, one of the main characters, the oldest son in the Friedman's family.
Yeah, that's right. When David and I got together, it was because David is the number one birthday party clown in New York, and I was doing this story, which, you know, was going to be kind of a quirky story. It wasn't going to be a straight story, but I thought he was an interesting character. And then the more time I spent with him, the more I realized that he was not telling me the full truth about his family. He was giving me these sort of very packaged, perfect stories. And knowing what I know about families, I thought that those were probably unreasonable. And then eventually I discovered that he had this secret story.
Police are charging that sexual abuse went on behind the doors of 17 Piccadilly Road in Great Neck. We rang the doorbell. As soon as he realized who it was, he wasn't going to let us in, so one of the detectives broke the door down. And
the movie unfolds like one door opening after another door. As soon as you think you've reached a point where, okay, this is what this movie's about, it goes on to another level. How much more difficult was it that this is a story that unfolds, that doesn't have a strictly direct narrative line?
You know, for some reason, I think it told itself in that way because I tried to make the film just as I had revealed information for myself. You know, when I started investigating the story, I kept going from person to person who was involved and trying to understand what their version of the story was. And I found there were all these incredibly articulate, smart people, but nobody could agree on anything.
3 years it took you to make the movie.
Yeah, that's right.
When did you realize that there was all this home video, both video and audio, that the Friedmans had taken of their own lives?
Well, at a certain point when I went back to David and I said, you know, you remember you said I was a smart guy, I could probably figure it out, but, you know, you didn't want to tell me this story about yourself. Well, I figured it out. You know, I had read about it at that point because I'd gone back and done Nexus searches and figured out that there was this incredibly salacious version of the events that was described in the media. And so I thought I should tell it. And he said, all right, if you're really going to make this other movie, I guess I should tell you that in addition to the 25 hours of home movies of my family during happy times that my father took and I shared with you earlier, there's another 25 hours of home videos, which I started taking after the police showed up at my house.
It's not your fault. The police are railroading you.
Mommy doesn't believe
it. The police picked on you, and that's who they're going after. It's not because you deserved it. You're taking the blame.
How important was it having access to all that?
Well, it was critical in terms of how the film has ended up. You know, I had cut the movie before I had access to the home videos. I knew that there were some home videos. I had no idea how intimate they would be when I finally saw them. So I had expected to make the movie without. And then, of course, when David showed me the first tape, which we called Jesse's Last Night, which is the night when, you know, there are three brothers and they stay up all night to say goodbye to the youngest one who's going to jail the next morning. I mean, it was so powerful. I knew that it would have to be a big part of the film.
What's today's date?
Today is the day before I went to jail.
Went to jail?
I'm going to jail.
Because we're watching it?
I'm going to be watching this after I'm already out of jail. After four and a half years because the case gets reopened. At this point in time, my life is as good as over. It is terminated at this point, only to resume at a later date.
Arnold Friedman was a pedophile, but the film leaves unclear just how much he molested kids.
Well, I think it does. I mean, I want to say one thing. For me, there is this crime at the center of the film. Sometimes the crime eats the discussion, and I think it's important just to say that for me, the story is about a family, and I try to stay focused on that. At the same time, you had to build all the information about the case because otherwise you don't know when you get into this family's home videos and you're sitting in the living room with them or you're sitting at the dinner table with them. You know, in this family, the video camera literally had a seat at the table at a number of dinners. You know, you start to realize that this crime has so totally overwhelmed the family and you can judge for yourself because you're there.
Why don't you try once to be supportive of me?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because we all started at the beginning of this thing,
Well, let's start from right now.
All right, let's start from right now. We're all starting brand new. We have a decision-making process on the table. It's clear. Great. All the past mistakes, they were mistakes. We're not going to hold them against anyone.
Great. Now we're starting afresh.
Okay.
Incredible scenes in the film that the family filmed themselves of the family tearing itself apart over this crime, as you refer to it. He was a pedophile. He was into child pornography. And ultimately, he admitted that he had molested children in another part of Long Island.
Right. Well, we used to say about Arnold that when we were editing the film, when we were sort of half kidding, we used to say that Arnold was always sort of taking the position that indignantly he would say, I am being accused of the wrong felonies. You know, but the reality is that it does matter what he was being accused of, particularly in this case, because here you have his 17, 18-year-old son, you know,
Jesse.
Who in this case went to jail for a very, very long time. And if you don't believe that Arnold was accused of the proper crimes, then there's no reason to believe that his son had anything to do with it. And that's a question that I think is raised for the audience.
Director Andrew Jarecki on the film Capturing the Friedmans. And we have this update.
Earlier this month, Jesse Friedman, who served 13 years in prison, filed a motion for a new trial based on information revealed in the film. His lawyer says that the prosecution withheld important facts that could have exonerated Jesse. Andrew Jarecki, the director, supports Jesse's efforts to win a new trial. Well, turning back to New Hampshire, the site of the first in the nation primary now underway until 8 this evening, we return to my co-host in Manchester, New Hampshire, Robin Young.
Hey, Bill, and I'm still joined by historian Dante Scala. Before we let him go, he's, of course, from St. Anselm's College here in Manchester. And Dante, you had some thoughts about the key to who might have success today.
I think the key to success today and in future primaries will be the candidate who can appeal in the working-class wards of Manchester, Nashua, Rochester, Somersworth, as well as appeal in the affluent towns of places like Peterborough and Bow and Rye. Historically, the candidate who's been able to bring together those two types of voters has had success here, but more importantly, down the road in future primaries.
Right. And I was surprised to hear some of our poll watchers this morning, people standing at the polls, saying that the turnout seemed to be soft. Where we were down the street at St. Anne's, it seemed to be a pretty heavy flow, but it was the elderly and women with their children. Do you expect by this evening New Hampshireites will be coming out?
Yeah, I suspect we'll see a lot of action between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock, and that's what makes the snow down in Massachusetts all the more important, because someone commuting from New Hampshire to Massachusetts coming back could get stuck in that snow.
And there are a lot of those people.
Absolutely, especially in places that should be Kerry country, border towns.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us again. Dante's book is called Stormy Weather, the New Hampshire Primary and Presidential Politics. For those who love this kind of thing, and we know a lot of you out there do, it's a must read. And also, we want to mention that our colleagues from All Things Considered are filing in here to headquarters here in Manchester, New Hampshire. You can follow the results all day on public radio and on this very station. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dante.
You're very welcome.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Special thanks today to April Peavy, our producer here in the Granite State and a terrific roommate. Thanks for your help. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Attention turns now to South Carolina, Arizona, and other states for next week's presidential primaries.
And a group of African-American women meet once a month to talk wine.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.